Hub.
And Spoke. Audio Collective.
You're listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe. It's not uncommon for kids to worry about death, often starting with the realization that your parents aren't going to live forever, then dawning into the knowledge of your own mortality.
I probably started thinking about death when I was maybe 7 years old, something like that. I remember pretty early running downstairs with this idea of death and like jumping in my mom's arms and being afraid and not being able to resolve it. And maybe setting it aside then, but then coming back to it when I was 10, 11, 12, something like that. And I started really to play with the idea and really try and imagine it, especially at night. You know, I think it's just like this natural intellectual curiosity that you have as a kid. And so I would lay in bed and I would close my eyes so I couldn't see, cover my ears so I couldn't hear. And then I would just lay perfectly still for as long as I could so I'd lose the sensation of having a body. But then you would think, and in death, the way I saw it, there are no thoughts. And so then I would get really freaked out because, oh, you can't even come close to replicating the nothingness of death. And that brought about all this panic. So I set it aside and continue just going about my life on the tracks that were laid out for me.
That's Tom Tursich. And for Tom, those tracks that were laid out for him involved a pretty happy childhood, growing up in suburban New Jersey, going to school, playing sports, and hanging out with friends. His anxiety about death was always there in the background, and it bugged him, but it wasn't impacting how he thought about life. Until one day in 2006, when he got the news about Anne-Marie.
It was a jet ski accident. And so it was very freakish and sudden and abrupt. And all this unresolved emotion and thoughts came back. Anne-Marie and I were childhood friends. We grew up just a block apart from each other. We were always very close. Anne-Marie passed away when I was 17. She was 16. I think what really was so impactful about her death was that she was always the nicest person I knew. And that's a sort of a platitude. When someone dies, everyone says that they were the nicest person they knew. But with Anne-Marie, it was true. And it was true to the point that when we would spend time together, she like drove me crazy from how nice and generous and understanding she was. And so when she died, it was this realization that, oh, if Anne-Marie can die, who is the best person I know, then I can die, then my other friends can die, then my family could die. And so it just really left me in a dark place for a while.
Tom could no longer just go about life as usual. The fact of death was front and center.
I had set it aside before, and all of a sudden it was at the forefront that, okay, time is limited. When Anne-Marie died, it brought all those unresolved questions back, but with a lot more emotion tied to them. And so death wasn't just this thing that existed as an idea that was an intellectual concept. And so suddenly I had this real sense of urgency to figure out what I wanted out of life and how to achieve it. So initially it was this months-long fog that sort of surrounded me, and I had no idea how to integrate the fact that I was going to die. And then someone played Dead Poets Society in a speech and communications class, and that gave me the first answers. The first way out of that fog was carpe diem.
Carpe diem. Seize the day.
Seize the day.
Make your lives extraordinary.
And it gave me some sense of purpose, some sort of answer, which was just taking action. And initially that meant just doing everything. My days were packed.
Tom lived carpe diem by joining the swim team and signing up for all the plays, making sure he was busy before and after school.
And so I was just cramming as much into my days as possible. But then at a certain point, I started to realize that, oh, you can direct your life by taking action. But it's important to then take the right actions and not just do things indiscriminately like I was doing initially. Initially, it was just action for the sake of action, just to be more alive. And you have to figure out what direction you want your life to take. And so I thought about what I valued and what I wanted out of life.
The question became, what did it mean to Tom to seize the day and to live life to the fullest? He reflected on how he had lived thus far.
I knew I was timid and introverted, and I wanted to overcome that by kind of just dropping myself into the deep end. So when I thought about that, I knew I wanted to travel, and I wanted to be forced into adventure and put myself in situations where I would be forced to grow and figuring out how to be more self-assured and self-reliant. And then I wanted to understand the world because it was big and complex, and I just knew nothing of it.
The winter after Anne-Marie died, Tom spent hours on the internet researching different modes of travel. He thought a backpacking trip in Europe might be the answer because he'd signed up early acceptance for college and he didn't have a lot of money to spend.
So I thought, okay, backpacking Europe, maybe that'll scratch an itch, but I want this to be like a permanent part of my life is traveling and adventure. And then through this rabbit hole, I discovered Carl Bushby and Steve Newman, these two guys who had walked around the world. And pretty much right away, once I saw that walking around the world was possible, it was like the beacon on the hill. And I knew it fulfilled everything I valued and that it would be long enough and immersive enough to really change who I was and to change my life. And it wouldn't just be this one-off trip.
Walking around the world is a somewhat loosely defined concept.
There's a few different definitions of it, and I think there's no hard and fast definition of it, but the one most commonly accepted is to walk the circumference of the Earth and then ocean to ocean on four continents.
So not the kind of endeavor one begins the summer between high school and college, but a seed had been planted. Tom spent the next 8 years going to school and then working while living at home, saving and paying off school loans.
It held on to me, and that became the direction that I aimed for.
Over those 8 years, Tom kept his plan pretty close to the vest, telling only his parents and a few friends.
I just didn't want to be the type of person who says he's going to do something and then never does it. And especially, you're walking around the world is an insane idea.
As Tom's plans solidified, it began to hit home for his parents, especially his mom, what a crazy idea it was. He led a pretty sheltered life.
I remember my mom, maybe the week before I left, her having Sunday dinner, and she was saying, why can't you just walk across America? Why does it have to be the world? It's so long, it's so far. And, you know, it's just her baby boy leaving home. And she also knew that I was essentially an idiot back then. I was just grew up in the suburbs and, you know, tall white male, very insulated from the world. And so I just knew, in reality, very little. And she knew that about me.
After college, Tom had worked installing solar panels, and he'd paid off most of his college loans and been able to save some money. He figured he might have enough to survive for a couple of years eating rice and beans and peanut butter. Then, 2 months before he was about to leave, a few local newspapers caught wind of Tom's plans and published some articles about his upcoming trip, including the role of Anne-Marie's death. And a local business owner in Philadelphia just happened to be looking for something to sponsor. In the end, he created a scholarship fund in Anne-Marie's name, as well as sponsored Tom's trip. It was less than minimum wage, but it allowed Tom to set off. It was time to start walking around the world. Tom's adventure began at home.
I started out my front door in New Jersey and walked down to Panama City. So it's through Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama, and then it was over to South America. And we walked Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, briefly took a boat to Antarctica, up to Iceland, and then Ireland, Northern Ireland, Scotland, a little bit of England, and then Denmark, Germany, Belgium, France, Spain, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, up Italy, along the Mediterranean, across Turkey. across Georgia, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and then back across the U.S. And as far as some highlights, I mean, Georgia was a very tiny little country that I knew nothing of before and was just incredible. It's just a young, vibrant democracy. I would say Colombia was a fantastic place as well. It was really mountainous, so that was tough going, walking the Andes every day and pushing up and down these mountains was so difficult.
Tom pushed a baby buggy throughout the walk, which he'd had customized to hold everything he'd need. Tent, sleeping bag, food crate, clothes, camera, laptop.
I would usually walk roughly 8 hours a day, sometimes seven, sometimes longer, depending on how hilly it was. The primary goal was to cover at least 21 miles.
Tom set himself no other goals for the trip other than number of daily miles. He was determined to experience every place with as much openness as possible.
I went in very much with the explicit mindset of just trying to not look at the world in any way and just letting myself discover it as I went. Just trying to let the world show itself to me. And one of the great benefits inherent in walking versus biking or flying into a place is that the only bias that was built into my route was that there was a path there or a road or a farm road, something like that. I wasn't able to skip over places if, you know, I heard they were dangerous or if it was, you know, a place I wanted to avoid. I had to pass through every village. I had to pass through every town.
One of the biggest challenges was figuring out where to sleep once the sun went down.
I walked across the Ben Franklin Bridge into Philadelphia, and then the first night I camped right beside the Schuylkill River bike path. But in the beginning, choosing where to sleep was a disaster. I had no idea what I was doing. And it was a lot of trial and error, especially on the East Coast of the U.S. because it's just so densely populated.
In the southern U.S., Tom found that churches were a good place to camp. They often had nice grassy spots, and he'd pass at least a dozen a day while walking. Tom would try to time things so that he wouldn't have to camp in big cities, and the ideal place to sleep varied based on where he found himself.
It depends on the landscape a lot. I mean, probably the most ideal was when I was walking the deserts of Peru and Chile, because when it was dark and I could just turn off the road and walk into the desert and disappear. And I would just lay out my tarp. I didn't even need to set up my tent because there's no rain, there's no bugs, and I could just fall asleep wherever. Other times, say like at the very beginning when I was in Mexico and by the border, I didn't really have a great judge of what is a safe neighborhood and what's not a safe neighborhood. I just hadn't traveled enough at that point. I didn't know the world well enough, so I was on high alert all the time. And I would just push super deep into the brush and sort of bury myself in there and wipe away a little clearing. But you know, the ideal is that you have a little clearing somewhere tucked away from the road where no one's going to wander in. It's public land and it's secluded and quiet. That's the ideal. But, you know, sometimes you got to get more creative than that. Most of the time you have to get more creative than that.
Even as Tom got better at finding good places to sleep, the quality of rest he was getting, camping on his own in strange places every night, was not ideal.
In the beginning, it was just a lot of panic and a lot of hearing things that didn't mean anything, that I didn't know how to tune out. There's this part of your brain that was very difficult to turn off, where I would just wake up probably four times a night thinking I heard something. You know, a twig would snap, it would be a rustle in the trees or something, and suddenly I'd wake up and be very high alert for maybe just a minute, 2 minutes, something like that. And then you go back to sleep. And so you never really get like a fully restful night. So a continual thought was, man, it would be nice to outsource this to a dog that I know would hear something far before I would. And so I could sleep peacefully. And then if something was coming, she could alert me.
A few months of poor sleep went by, and Tom was in Austin, Texas, staying with some cousins. The first day, they went off to work, and Tom decided to check out a nearby adoption center just for fun. He wasn't really planning on anything. Tom was looking at all the dogs when a volunteer brought out two adorable little retrievers who had been found on the side of a highway.
They were just puppies, they were like 3 months old. And I held Savannah and I thought, okay, maybe, I don't know. And then I was about to leave. Actually, I was leaving and I was thinking, it's too crazy. I can't, like, my first day in Austin, I can't just adopt a puppy to bring with me into Mexico and Nicaragua and all the way down to Uruguay.
As Tom was about to leave, a woman who was also looking at the puppies remarked that if he didn't adopt Savannah, she'd be gone in 10 minutes because puppies never last.
And so she sort of forced my hand where I thought, you know, if I adopted this puppy, she would be very young and she would require training and she wouldn't be able to walk at the beginning. But also then she would know no other life on the road. And so I sort of played around with it. But then I adopted her, and that first month was very difficult. And she sat in the back basket of the baby carriage I pushed around the world for a while. And she was terrified of cars and she hated the leash and she didn't listen to me at all. But by the time we reached Mexico, she was walking the full 24 miles a day. And if I tried to put her in the cart, she would jump out of it. She wanted nothing to do with it. And so she grew up on the road and we just became perfectly adapted, perfectly synced up together. And it helped a lot. It definitely allowed me to rest a little easier. And I got much better at just turning off that worry in my brain.
So now Tom had someone to help him sleep better on the road. And he also had a steady companion, someone to walk every step with. The first year of walking, with the exception of a few weeks off in Texas and then in Guatemala, Tom and Savannah walked 24 miles a day.
Generally, like a full day would be about 24 miles, which is about 7 to 8 hours. But sometimes you're pushing up a mountain and that 24 miles can take 10 hours. So I was just on fire with this desire to prove that I could do this thing.
Even though they were always on the move, they were often not alone.
I would have a lot of people walk with me. I would have maybe a fisherman that was just finishing for the day walk with me for a little bit, or some kid pushing a bike and going home, he would walk with me for a little bit. So I walked with a lot of locals that first year. And I was invited into a few homes in Central America. But in South America, when my Spanish became pretty strong, then it was fairly frequent that I would get invited into people's homes, either for lunch or just for a drink or maybe for the night as well.
Despite these interactions with people as they walked, ultimately it was just Tom and Savannah arriving to a place for a short time and then moving on.
The interactions with locals was always pretty constant, but also pretty transitory in the sense of that I was always moving. I would get a peek into someone's life and then I would be gone after a day or two. And then it was on to the next thing. And that, in a certain way, is very nice because I had this purpose that was always driving me forward. But as the years went on, it became really difficult because I just didn't have these deep connections. And even if they were deep, they were still only temporary.
Sometime during the second year of walking, things started shifting for Tom. It was kind of like a mental cleansing.
When I was walking Peru and Chile in the desert for months and just spending so much time in solitude with myself, with my thoughts, you know, when you're walking, it's this really subtle but also really profound experience. And it takes a while to notice. I think when I first started walking, I didn't notice the process of walking, what's happening mentally and emotionally behind the scenes. I notice it now when I walk, but before I didn't. And basically your memories are just cropping up and then falling aside and then cropping up again and falling aside. And it's almost like you're looking at your life in this ever-shifting prism where one moment you're looking at it from this angle, then you look at it from the next angle, and then you look at it this angle. And eventually you've looked at it from every angle imaginable and you go, okay, well, I've looked at it every way I know how. I'm just going to set it aside. And so when I was in Peru and Chile, that went on and on and on and on and on for months. And I really started to feel like I was reflecting this emptiness and this vastness of the landscape that I was passing through. And then in the Atacama in Chile, I'm laying under the most incredible, beautiful night sky where there's no humidity, no rain ever, and just a billion stars are above me. And I just felt totally, you know, empty. And I had this thought of, what is a man supposed to build his life on? Because I had stripped down everything else and I needed to build back up again.
By the time Tom got to the Atacama Desert in Chile, the night no longer felt like something to get through. Now he was able to settle in and reflect on the day's progress, as well as on the transformation of his own inner landscape.
It changed a lot as the years went on, but by the end, it was probably my favorite part of the day was the night, because I put in this good day work, I was tired, and there was a lot of excitement around finding hopefully a good place to sleep. And once I finally found a place to sleep, a great field or a little hilltop or wherever it was, and then at the end of the day, I'd sit down and I'd be tired and I'd start cooking my pasta and Savannah would be next to me, and then I would get to take in where I was and really bask in how far I'd come that day. And then as it's getting dark and I climb into the tent and I huddle up and I get my book out, and after I did a little reading, I would just turn on my back and just stare up at the sky. And the amount of stars you would see out there was indescribable, where you could feel them sitting on your chest. It's this real, visceral expression of just how small you are. And you feel it even more so in the desert when there's nothing around and it's just you out on the sand and these 100 million stars sitting on you.
Not all of Tom's experiences walking around the world were quite that transcendent. There were some harrowing moments.
Yeah, there's a few stories. In El Salvador, a few days in, I saw the bodies of a husband and wife who had been executed in a field. So that was very jarring. It was gang violence. They just shot in the back of the head. And then in Panama, I was held up at knife point. It was my last day of walking, and I had this guy hold a knife to me. I was sitting down for breakfast and he kind of worked me into the shop, and another guy came and grabbed my backpack, and then the guy with the knife took off. So it was this team job, basically.
Probably the most dramatic incident occurred in Turkey.
In Turkey, I'm walking sort of the center and the south of Turkey, and I'm pretty close to Syria, and I'm walking these mountains just north of Syria, and I take this very remote rocky path going up there, thinking, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be so quiet and secluded, and I'll get a great night's sleep up in this forest where there's nothing up there. And as I'm just about to crest this mountain path, a motorcycle comes over the hill, guy jumps off and points a shotgun at me. And so the shotgun is held to my chest. And first I'm envisioning, okay, I'm gonna have this huge hole in my chest and I'll be dead and this is where I die. And then I think, I hope they don't kill Savannah and I won't have posted for a few days, but a lot of people have my GPS tracking. Maybe Savannah will stay here. And if not, there's the village down near there, though at least my parents will be able to find Savannah. And so that's what I'm thinking about.
The guys start rifling through Tom's backpack, but they don't take anything. So it begins to dawn on him that this isn't a robbery. One of the guys asks for his passport, and Tom also gives him his driver's license.
We're in a very remote region of Turkey, so I don't have any service. And these guys speak no English. I speak very little Turkish. And so we have really no way to communicate. But I know they think the passport's fake and they think the license is fake. I don't know why. They walk me up to the top of this knoll, and the entire time this guy has the shotgun to my back, and it's incredibly tense.
The guys load Tom into the back of a pickup truck with Savannah and his cart and drive 20 minutes through the woods to a remote substation where there are more guys who are clearly military.
So I know there's some sort of operation here, but this one lieutenant speaks some English, and so he's questioning me about what I'm doing up here. And they were really curious about the cart. Like, what is this cart? Did you fly with this cart? How did you get this cart here? Where did you fly into with this thing? You know, what's in it? Why do you push this? And the guy who was very intense, who had cocked the shotgun the entire time, he's standing directly ahead of me, probably 15 feet away or so, but he has his hand in his shirt holding onto a pistol, like just ready to fire on me. And I'm telling these guys what I'm doing. And eventually I am able to convince them to let me use my phone. And there's just enough internet now where I'm able to pull up like just
my profile on Instagram and a few photos, and I show them that, and then these guys lost it, and they were so excited.
Tom had been documenting the whole trip on Instagram, and he had a lot of followers.
They saw that I was verified, and they saw, somehow they didn't believe the passport, they didn't believe the license, but when they saw the Instagram page, they believed every word I was saying. And this guy who had been very intense and had his hand on the gun, I see him switch hands and he reaches into the other pocket and he pulls out a cigarette and lights a cigarette. And then it was after like 3 hours, I finally relaxed. And it turned out, in actuality, all these guys, they were all really friendly. And in a certain way, they were, you know, the good guys. They were plainclothes military. And there had been some bombings in the area, some terrorist activity. So they thought I was a terrorist, but it all worked out.
Over the 7 years that Tom and Savannah walked around the globe, things did ultimately work out. Tom got pretty sick with a bacterial infection, which brought him and Savannah home for several months. And COVID happened, which meant he couldn't get into Australia. And those two things ate up almost 2 years. But he did what he set out to do. And his view of the world was transformed.
My experience overwhelmingly was that people were good. And the primary thing the world showed me was that people are the same everywhere. I think when you first start traveling, it's very easy and maybe even unavoidable that you have this concept of what a place is in your head. For me, it was El Salvador and Peru. When I imagined myself in them, I thought of them, wow, it's going to be so incredibly foreign. I just can't even imagine what life is like there. And then when you get there, you go, oh, no, this is just people living like anywhere else. You know, the food is a little different. The landscape's different. Maybe the dress is different. But it's just people living, trying to make a little money and then hang out with their family. And you saw that over and over and over and over again, where really there was no foreign place. It was just people just living their life. The other thing I would say that I learned was that very, very little of anyone's life is determined by their intelligence or their willpower or their desire to improve their lot in life. And the overwhelming majority of someone's life is decided by the geography they're born into, the political system they're born into, the economic situation that they're born into. I did met so many people along the walk that were kinder than I was, more intelligent than I was. And they were working at a little restaurant in the desert, or they were in a country with no chance of ever getting out because of the passport that they were born into. And I was walking around the world. And so you just kind of saw over and over and over again how much the individual person's life is affected by forces that are far greater than them. It just really drove home the importance of good systems and good governance and trying to promote healthier, more democratic systems in the world. And I had this thought when I was laid out under the stars in the Atacama that the ultimate goal is happiness. When you search for money to try and be happy, you want security so you can be happy. And ultimately, happiness is the measure. And so I'd say the meaning of life is to be happy and try and create happiness. And I think the best way to create the most amount of gross happiness is to promote democracy, economic growth, and give people the best chance to just make a little money and spend time with their family.
So Tom learned a lot from pushing way past his comfort zone. Walking around the world brought him peace, and the journey deepened his understanding of what's important in life. Savannah was also a teacher. She'd become a lot more than providing comfort at night.
Yeah, initially I got her because I wanted to sleep better at night, and she definitely served that purpose. And in actuality, she would have been a terrible protector if someone came in the middle of the night. She would have been so friendly and would not have cared. But then, you know, spending every minute of every day together and going through this really intense, you know, experience forged us almost into like this single unit where we were so synced up. She had grown up on the road, walking every day with me, And language wasn't really needed because she knew what I wanted of her. And when she needed something, I knew what she needed, what she wanted, how she felt. And she just showed herself to be such a beast over and over and over again. She was so tough. And by the end, it was like I was just in perpetual awe of her. She's so excited all the time, and she's so friendly. So it went from, hey, I hope you offer some protection at night, to just being thankful that I get to experience life with her.
After walking 28,000 miles through 38 countries on 6 continents, Tom and Savannah finally arrived home on May 21st, 2022. As they walked through Philadelphia, people started joining them for the final stretch. There was a giant party at the finish line with music and an archway of balloons to walk through. Everyone cheered.
The homecoming was incredible. And for probably 3 months, I was on cloud 9. But after 3 months, I had this really strange thought. I was like, oh, life keeps going. In the sense of the world walk had been so important to me for so long, and it was my sole purpose in life. And then once it was complete, I was honestly amazed that I didn't just evaporate, or I didn't just die. I didn't just disappear into the ether.
As the homecoming party faded into the past, Tom struggled without the overarching sense of purpose he'd experienced over the last 7 years.
It was a real sense of loss for sure. And probably the only time, the only time I'd say I'd fallen into a depression. And it was a few things. It was that I had just ingrained this habit. And so I found it really difficult to be in one place.
Savannah was having a hard time too.
She really struggled. And she would just sit by the door. And she had all this energy. She didn't know what to do with.
And so Savannah and I would walk like 4 hours a day just for something to do, because I couldn't sit down and just stay still. And then the other thing was that life, when I'm on the road, just comes at me just through the act of walking. I'm discovering things. I'm talking to new people. I'm eating new foods. And then once that was over and I wasn't walking into new places every day, I was so confused as to why the world wasn't coming at me. And it took me a long time to realize, oh no, like I have to make plans, and I have to sign up for classes, and I have to go out of my way to experience life. And so that was a real challenge and a real difficult transition, was just being more proactive in the way I interacted with the world.
Tom eventually figured it out. He spent a few months at home in New Jersey with his family. And then he and Savannah moved out to Seattle to be with his girlfriend, Beth, who he'd met on the last leg of the walk in Washington, D.C. Savannah adjusted too.
You know, gradually she learned like the suburban life, you know, the cushy suburban existence. She loved the sofa. She loved her bed. She was glad to be in the AC. And I would sit out on the back deck and read pretty often. And I'd be like, come on, Sav, come on out. And she would walk out for a minute and then just be looking out the door to go back into the air conditioning. So I think she definitely earned the air conditioning. She earned that sofa time.
7 years is long enough.
Sadly, Savannah passed away just a couple of months ago. She wasn't seeming herself. And Tom took her to the vet, who diagnosed kidney failure. They were both bitten by a lot of ticks during the walk. And even with tick collars, that can cause kidney problems in dogs.
But I thought, okay, maybe somehow pull her out of this. It was a week in the hospital. It was really terrible. It was probably, you know, maybe the worst week of my life. And what is especially difficult was that I made this deal with myself and with her when we were walking that I would always sleep where she slept. It meant if I could get a hotel for myself but not for her, then we weren't getting a hotel. And so she would never be out. And that was just the deal. And the last week in the hospital was the only week that we weren't under the same roof. So that was difficult to deal with. And then after she passed, I had really dealt with a lot of guilt. And I think that stemmed from basically being her protector around the world for 7 years and then not being able to protect her.
And then I had this realization the other day when I was out walking in the morning, and I was imagining reaching down and rubbing her ear like I always did. And I kind of realized that that's why
I walked around the world is for those memories. It's for the experiences. I'm the 10th person to walk around the world, and Savannah is the first dog to walk around the world, which obviously is incredible. And, you know, she earned it. She's a beast. She was a badass. And I had such an appreciation for this, like, incredible life that I lived with her, that I got to share with her, and that she got to live. You know, it's a bond that we shared, a dog and a man out there walking every day. And that memory, the memory of Savannah, that's the gift. That's the thing I earned. So now I kind of have this greater appreciation for time I had with her.
Tom lives in Cincinnati with his girlfriend. He wrote a children's book called Crossing the Andes, which is part one of the Savannah's World of Adventure series. And his memoir, The World Walk, is due out in October. He also does a lot of speaking engagements, drawing on wisdom from his 7-year epic adventure.
Which I find really enjoyable and something that I never would have done before. I would have felt like such a fraud, but now feel like I have actual valuable things to say. So it's turned into a very satisfying and gratifying life for sure. I mean, for however beautiful the world walk was and insightful and full of wonder, I am glad I did it while I was young, because I don't know if I have it in me to do it again.
You've been listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe. Nocturne is produced by me and was created by myself and Kent Sparling, who also composed the theme music. Most of the music in this episode was composed by David C. Hughes. I'll post a link for Tom Tursich at our website, nocturnepodcast.org, in the show notes for this episode. You can also find lots of information about the show and all the beautiful episode art at the website. Thank you to everyone who supports Nocturne on Patreon and PayPal. Big, huge thanks to Kim Thompson Kerr, who's in the Happy Possum tier, which is our highest level of support. Nocturne is 100% listener supported. No more ads. So please go now to nocturnepodcast.org/support and help keep the show going strong. That's nocturnepodcast.org/support. Till next time, thanks for listening and be well.